You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Anatole.
Hello there.
How you doing?
Could be worse.
Oh, yeah? How? How about it? What would make things even worse than they are in the world today, Anatole? Come on.
Things could always get worse.
I don't know, man. Okay, so let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is Non-Zero Podcast. You're Anatole Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington. You have previously taught at King's College London, and you've written a number of books, including one on Pakistan. I want to talk a little about Pakistan toward the end because there is tension in the wake of that Kashmir terrorism incident between Pakistan and India. But mainly I want to talk about Ukraine. And that's where I was hoping you could actually cheer me up and convince me that peace is at hand, that there will be peace in our time. But it doesn't feel that way to me. But you know a lot more about this stuff than I do. So what's your take?
Well, as the Sergeant Major said, nobody ever said it was going to be easy, except, of course, Trump, when he said he'd solve this in 24 hours. But he now says that was a joke.
That's funny.
It's going to take a great deal more effort and pressure to bring, you know, the two sides to an agreement. And I'm not sure that, you know, the Trump administration has the patience for it, because, I mean, both sides have given up their most extreme positions. I mean, it seems that, you know, at least to judge by his statement, you know, Putin has given up the demand that Ukraine withdraw from, you know, territory they still hold in these four provinces. That's
big of him, but go ahead.
Well, but, you know, I mean, the point is, that's one of the things that Ukrainians simply could not do.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't consider that a significant concession, but...
Well, I mean,
I don't consider it realistic for either side to expect much in the way of withdrawal from territory held. That's not the way these things work. But
no, well, exactly. You know, the Ukrainians similarly have given up and the Europeans have given up, it seems, their demand that Russia withdraw from the territory that it holds, right, which also was not going to happen, except possibly, you know, very limited territorial swaps. So, in principle, therefore, both sides have agreed that the ceasefire line should run along the existing battle line, which is what realism always said that it would. But, you know, so many other things. Oh, and clearly, I mean, Ukraine was never going to get into NATO because NATO was never going to fight to defend Ukraine. So that's off the table. The British, the latest statement about this so-called European Reassurance Force, which the British and French were pushing. But the latest statement from Britain acknowledges that's not going to happen, because the British always said it would need a US backup, and the US under Trump have refused to agree to that.
And do you know what the minimum that a backstop would have had to be is? Like, do they mean intelligence? I mean, they didn't expect U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine, right?
Well, that was the great question. They never said what a backstop meant, but basically, I mean, it must have meant that if those troops go to Ukraine and then find themselves at war with Russia, the U.S. will back them up. We'll come to their rescue.
Well, there are different ways to back people up. I mean, you can guarantee them intelligence support and arms, for example. And I would think that enough would be sufficient deterrent to keep Russia from messing with them. But
no.
Who knows?
No. I think we do know. The Russians have made very clear to me that for them, Western troops in Ukraine is the equivalent of...
Oh, I understand that. I'm saying it would be a sufficient deterrent to Russian attack. I mean, look, Ukraine understandably wants something in the way of security guarantees in some sense, right? I know Russia has said they won't accept European troops in Ukraine. I'm just saying that when let's assume that there were some troops there. And when Britain says they need a U.S. backstop, I'm saying you can imagine a U.S. backstop that is well short of U.S. troops on the ground, but nonetheless would surely constitute sufficient deterrent as a practical matter to keep Russia from attacking the European troops, to keep Russia from committing a further aggression. That's my only point. I take your point that Russia has said they won't even accept that. They won't even accept European troops on the ground in any form. I take your point. Well, let me ask you this. Don't you agree that if you were Ukraine, it would not be, you would not feel secure enough to just see words on paper and Putin signed something? That alone would not make you feel like Russia's not going to attack you again. You would need more than that, right?
Well, you want more than that, but the question is what you will get. Because, I mean, the Russians have not said to me that they won't accept European troops in Ukraine. They've said they will attack European troops in Ukraine, because they would see that as the thin end of the wedge, as the first step towards the full military integration of Ukraine mm-hmm. West, which is what they went to war to prevent. So no, I mean, the US has to be prepared to actually go in and fight Russia at that point, which of course Trump will not do, but Biden said he wouldn't do either. So no, I mean, Ukraine will, I think, have to settle for less than that, because look, even the Poles, who are supposedly Ukraine's biggest supporters in Europe, have said they won't send troops. Mm-hmm. It was really the British and French. And then, you know, you also had a retired British general. The British have one brigade that they can deploy immediately. Mm-hmm. He talked in terms of needing to designate 40, you know, counting, of course, retraining and R&R and so forth, designate 40,000 men from the British Army for this task. Well, there are not 40,000 fighting men in the British Army anymore. They just don't exist. They're not there, or in the French. So it was never really a practical possibility. Peacekeepers will have to come from the United Nations.
So that's what you imagine as part of any peace deal, is UN troops, which have rarely been considered formidable, but you think would serve as an effective buffer.
Well, I mean, the thing is, look, it's there isn't any external force on Earth that could stop the could itself stop the Russians if the Russians were determined to go back to war, in terms of, you know, fighting capacity. The point there would be, I mean, it would depend on where the troops came from. But if, for example, you had a peacekeeping force largely composed of, Indians, Brazilians, South Africans, if they've got any troops, the Russians would be extremely unwilling to kill them, because, you know, Russia has devoted so much effort to wooing mm-hmm. those countries. It would be a deterrent. But the thing is that the only, I mean, in history, in reality, in life, there are no absolute guarantees.
Yeah, well, no, sure. But when I said, words on paper aren't enough for Ukraine, well, UN troops is more than words on paper. Is Ukraine not, Ukraine has not said they're willing to accept that, though, as sufficient security?
Well, the Ukrainians haven't said anything on that subject yet. But there is another aspect to this, which is that, you know, as this war has demonstrated, I mean, for the moment, no change in military technology lasts forever. But at the moment, it's very clear that recent developments in weaponry hugely favor the defensive. Right. And you know, if the Ukrainians can lay enough mines, and if those mines are covered by artillery and, much more importantly, drones, mm-hmm. Because the thing is, of course, minefields can be cleared, but how are they cleared? Well, they're cleared either by extremely expensive pieces of machinery or, still, most of the time, by men on foot with metal detectors or just sticks poking the ground. Now, the point is, this takes a very long time. Today, a man out in a minefield with a drone hovering overhead and staying in, you know, in the open for an hour or more mm-hmm. is a dead man. So the point is, you know, it is, I think, entirely possible to build up the Ukrainian defences to the point where the Russians would know that they couldn't achieve a blitzkrieg style sudden breakthrough. Of course, the Ukrainians would have to go on getting access to American satellite intelligence so that we mm-hmm. and the Ukrainians would know when, if Russian troops were accumulating. But I think it's entirely possible to build up Ukrainian defenses to the point where, once again, as in this war, the Russians would not achieve a quick breakthrough and would pay a huge price. But by the way, I mean, we and the Ukrainians always talk about, the threat of the Russians restarting the war. But there will be Ukrainian extremist forces who will undoubtedly want to carry on what they would call a war of resistance. But the Russians will call terrorism in terms of assassinating mm-hmm. pro-Russian officials, possibly going on assassinating generals and people in Moscow, as has just happened.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, a well-placed bomb killed a general in Russia.
Yeah. Cuts both ways. And I mean, obviously, a European force in Ukraine would give tremendous cover and encouragement to such groups to do this, because they'd reckon that if this started a new war, the West would come in to protect them.
So you think the reasonable end game is UN troops, but has either side, you said Ukraine has not discussed that. You said, have Russians signaled that they would accept UN peacekeeping troops?
Yes, there have been signals to that effect.
Is one side more the problem than the other? I mean, is one side further away from what seems to you the natural end game?
Well, very hard to say, frankly, because both positions still include elements which are clearly unacceptable, or at least some of the things on the Russian side are not entirely clear, but could well be completely unacceptable. On the Russian side, Lavrov's latest interview talks about Ukrainian demilitarization. Well, if that's simply a ban on long-range missiles, that's possible. I mean, the Austrian State Treaty of 1954, if I remember rightly, banned Austria at that time from possessing main battle tanks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Russians insist in negotiations, and remember that on that, we don't know the details of what have been discussed between the Americans and the Russians, and B, we don't know how far they've got yet. Mm-hmm. But if the Russians try to insist on much more than that, on reducing the Ukrainian armed forces to a level where they can't defend Ukraine, well, no Ukrainian government could or should possibly accept that. Lavrov talked about denazification. Well, he was, when he went into details, he was talking mainly about the rights of Russian speakers in Ukraine. Once again, that can be addressed at the Istanbul talks at the start of the war. There was a very sensible formula that both sides must guarantee linguistic rights on their territory. So the Russians would also guarantee linguistic and cultural rights to Ukrainians on Russian territory, which is not a problem for the Russians, largely because most Ukrainians in Russia wouldn't particularly want it. But okay, so if the Russians will reduce denazification to that, okay. But if they are still insisting on talking about denazification as the banning of Ukrainian political parties, the resignation of Zelensky, well, no, I mean, also not acceptable. Now, on the Western side, on the European side, the Europeans have said, well, we want a permanent ceasefire, but leaving you know, except for the de facto territorial division, all these other questions open that the Russians want to negotiate. Oh, and we won't lift sanctions, which is part of the US plan. We won't lift sanctions. We will be willing to talk about maybe gradually reducing sanctions over time. Well, why on earth would the Russians agree to that? It's simply a recipe for the sanctions going on forever. So both sides.
At the same time, I would say the gradual reduction of sanctions has the benefit of giving Russia a clear incentive to abide by any agreement that it won't commit further aggression. And that might give some reassurance to Ukraine, right?
Well, I think a more sensible version of that would be, you know, what's being called snapback sanctions. Mm-hmm. I think that phrase was coined for the Iranian nuclear deal, whereby you don't lift the sanctions, you suspend them, and there is an automatic clause that they will come back if some, you know.
But can snapback always really? Is it really automatic, or if views change in the participating countries, can the snap back fail to happen?
If views change in the participating countries, the sanctions will fail to happen. I mean, we'll stop.
Sometimes they're kind of sticky. But anyway, let me ask you a question about Trump's strategy. So this thing he's done recently of like, if you guys don't agree to a deal, we're leaving. That seems to me to presuppose that both sides very much want a deal right now. And I have not been paying much attention to this, but my intuition is that actually Russia is not in a great hurry. It's not their country that's getting decimated. They're slowly gaining ground, if at some cost. And, you know, so I mean, what do you think the logic is behind this Trump's threat to go home, which I guess maybe he has done now. I don't know. But
well, I mean, the threat, I mean, this is the key question. You know, if the U.S. simply walks away from the talks, we're just back the way we were under Biden, right? The war continues. Right. But it's a question of who he blames. If he blames the Ukrainians and the Europeans and also ends U.S. aid, military aid, intelligence aid to Ukraine, that's a quite different matter. You know, then Ukraine is in a much worse position. So, I mean, obviously what's going on at the moment is also, you know, a dance whereby the Russians and Ukrainians both try to, you know, offer enough to prevent Trump from blaming them for mm-hmm. the breakdown of the talks. I mean, I do think a lot of pressure is going to be needed. The incentive for Russia is just that, you know, for the first time in many, many, many years with Trump, there is a chance of a really serious reset of a quite new relationship between Russia and the U.S. And, you know, the U.S. lifting sanctions and therefore, you know, and getting the Europeans to lift sanctions, which would be of great benefit to the Russian economy. It would reduce Russia's dependence on China. Now, the problem is, and this is why the Russians are so determined to get a signed agreement. I mean, ideally, you know, a treaty, something, you know, ratified by the UN, by the US Congress, if that's possible, ratified by the Ukrainian parliament, is that the Russians are quite aware that the Democrats could win in the US in 2028 and tear up any agreement. Mm-hmm. So the Russians want, you know, things pretty firmly nailed down before mm-hmm. they will pull off what, as you say, is a war that at the moment is going in their direction, although very, very slowly. And of course, the Ukrainians, their incentive is to retain US, I mean, not just supplies and money, but from the military point of view, most important of all, intelligence, because it's US satellite intelligence that and the targeting intelligence, you know, human terrain mapping, that has been so critical to the Ukrainian war effort.
Yeah. So it seems to me right now the U.S. has a lot more in the way of just immediate leverage over Ukraine. Yes, Russia would like sanctions and a lot of other things. But the U.S. is currently giving Ukraine stuff that Ukraine definitely needs to maintain right now, military support. There is no such leverage on that Trump has on the Russian side. It seems to me that may be the structural problem here. And what's funny is that about a year before the election, Trump laid out what he would do to solve that problem, and he hasn't done it. What he said was, I'm gonna come up with a deal, and I'm gonna tell Ukraine, if you don't sign on this deal, I'm taking your weapons away. And I'm gonna say to Russia, if you don't sign this deal, I'm gonna give Ukraine a lot more weapons. That's the part he hasn't done. And he could do that in a nanosecond. He could get Congress to give him several billion of arms that at his discretion, in increments, he can give to Ukraine. And he can say to Russia, look, I want a ceasefire right now. No more bombs, nothing. I want a ceasefire. And if Russia says no, he says, well, OK, here's 30,000 artillery shells for Ukraine. I mean, and I really believe that if he used that leverage, which I think he in principle has, he could get both sides to a deal pretty quickly, because as we've said, he's got the leverage over Ukraine.
Yeah, but the thing is, an early ceasefire won't.
He could follow all the way to the finish line, pushing Russia every step and Ukraine every step, because he would have leverage over both of them.
Yeah, but for that, you actually have to have a pretty detailed U.S. plan.
You mean a competent administration? I admit this is very hypothetical, but yeah, why couldn't we come up with a detailed plan if we had a competent administration?
Oh, look, I agree with you. I mean, but that is why. So many people have said. I mean, Witkoff seems personally competent, but he's obviously hugely overburdened, you know, with different negotiations, and he's not an expert on Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. There are people who are, but either they are, you know, from Trump's point of view, too compromised by association with the Biden administration and opposed to a peace settlement, or he thinks so, or he just hasn't called on them.
Have on his staff, like with him, much in the way of actually experienced diplomats, because peace deals are complicated. I mean, I don't know that much about them, but I can tell it's the kind of thing where there's all these things that could go wrong. And if you don't have experience in this business, you're not going to attend to them all. And you're not going to come up with a deal that holds.
Yeah, absolutely. But it has to be said. I mean, I have my own peace plan, which I regard as... as rational, reasonably fair, about as good as it gets. If I were in Witkoff's place or advising him, I couldn't guarantee that either side would actually agree to it, because both sides would have to, you know, give up their maximalist positions and accept some very, you know, painful compromises. And also, of course, you know, when it comes to sanctions and the fate of Russia's assets, you do have to have the Europeans on board, because, you know, they also have to cancel their sanctions, and they also have to come to some agreement with Russia about the use of the assets to reconstruct Ukraine. And of course, there's no guarantee that they will all do this. But you do need a clear plan. It's true.
So what is your plan that you consider rational?
Ceasefire has to run along the battle lines. Reciprocal guarantees for Russian speakers in Ukraine and Ukrainian speakers in Russia. Limitations on Ukrainian weaponry that can strike deep into Russia, but not on, you know, key defensive weapons or on the size of the Ukrainian army. NATO membership out, so neutrality. Actually, as has also been agreed. I mean, Russia has also said this is acceptable, but EU membership possibility. I mean, you know, that it's open to Ukraine to seek EU membership. Sanctions suspended and...
with snapback.
With snapback. And the seized Russian assets are put into a joint fund with the EU under the UN for the reconstruction of Ukraine, but with, yeah, have been negotiated, but say half of the Russian assets devoted to reconstructing the Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine. So, you know, it's, they're not just seized. They, some of it goes back to Russia. And both sides guarantee the legal status of the territories is left open for future negotiation with, you know, perhaps, you know, some reference to the fact that the role of, you know, the essential role of local people, of the inhabitants in deciding where they should go. But both sides guarantee not to change, not to try to change the ceasefire line by force or economic pressure, and provision for a UN peacekeeping force and this treaty to be signed and ratified under the UN. That it seems,
and UN, and Ukraine keeps a substantial military, but no, like, I guess HIMARS missiles or something, no long range strike weapons. Okay, and now on Crimea, this I don't understand. Can you tell me why Trump seems to have already almost given them U.S. recognition of Russia's sovereignty over Crimea? I mean, why say that now? He didn't get. Who said that? Trump said that, or Witkoff said it? Trump said it.
Hmm.
Well, why say that? Why? That's dumb, right? Like, you should wait and get something in return for concessions. I mean, well, I'm against it. I should say I'm against the U.S. recognizing that. And I don't think you have to give that to Russia. But that aside, why would you give it to them now? What did Russia do in exchange?
Well, I mean, the thing is that, look, the U.S. has not given it to them and actually can't.
Well, the U.S. can say we will recognize, you know, just the way they recognize Israel's control of the Golan Heights, right? They recognize the annexation of the Golan Heights, right? And Russia wants them to do the same with respect to Crimea.
Yes, but if this is part, I mean, look, I'm no constitutional expert, and I don't know quite what is possible or not. Obviously, as you say, with the Golan Heights and the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, this was a decision of the executive. But if recognition of the Russian annexation of Crimea is part of a peace treaty, it won't happen because you need two-thirds of the Senate, and there is no way that any Democrats in the Senate would agree to that. So this is not a done thing. It's in the form of an offer to get the Russians to move. But I mean, when it comes to, because there's all this talk of how Ukraine must recognize de facto Russian control, of the other occupied territories, you know, the other four provinces. Mm-hmm. But by agreeing to a ceasefire, Ukraine has done that. In fact, practically speaking, if you look at the interviews with Ukrainian officials in private, they've done that simply because they've accepted that they cannot reconquer these territories by force. So, in private, they have accepted de facto Russian control. But de jure control, legal sovereignty, is of course, a much, much more complicated issue.
Yeah, and Ukraine is, of course, not going to recognize Russia's legitimate control of Crimea. And in general,
Bob, the only thing is that, you know, we say this because we have become so hung up on our version of international legality. But after all, you know, we did separate Kosovo from Serbia.
Which was illegal, by the way, but go ahead.
Well, yes. So, you know, in the end, this is, and as you say, the US, I mean, nobody else, but the US has recognized totally illegal under international law Israeli actions. So actually, these things are adjustable. Now, in an earlier era.
Okay, but all that is different from saying Ukraine would recognize it. I just think that seems politically very, very challenging for Zelensky
to get. It is. Yeah. And therefore, I don't think it's possible or going to happen. But all I'm saying is that, you know, in a previous era of the world, you know, going all the way, you know, up to after the Second World War, when borders were massively changed, if you had put forward a deal saying, in return for the legal recognition of Russian sovereignty over territory that Russia already controls and Ukraine cannot get back, in return for this, Russia drops all its other demands against Ukraine, except possibly neutrality. Bismarck or Metternich, you know, or even Acheson probably would have considered this a very good deal for Ukraine, because the territory is lost anyway, and Ukraine is not getting it back.
Russia's other claims aside from neutrality that they would be surrendering and would mean so much to Ukraine?
Well, I mean, it's demilitarization above all.
But that's a ridiculous demand. I mean, I know it doesn't matter what I think, but
wait, it's a ridiculous thing if the present battle lines remain as they are. But if the Ukrainians are so exhausted, you know, if their army basically is so tired, or of course, if the US does walk away and no longer provide aid, that the Ukrainian army collapses, then nothing is ridiculous, because the Russians will dictate the peace.
As you said, recent technological developments favor defense. And what's interesting is, you can imagine Ukraine suddenly developing substantially stronger defenses via the influx of some new generation of drones or something, right? Because I gather that, for example, the drones have been pretty damn effective, but Russia is kind of good at jamming them, and that limits their effectiveness. But to the extent that they use artificial intelligence to increase the range with which the drones operate autonomously, so if the last mile toward the target doesn't require GPS or whatever, but can work via the autonomous controls on the drone, that's a total game changer. For that matter, I assume sheer quantity can be a game changer. And one thing I've never understood is why the Ukrainians weren't benefiting more in terms of drones and drone technology from their relationship with the West. I mean, I remember I said to my former podcast partner, Mickey Kaus, near the beginning of the war, like, this is an indictment of the military-industrial complex, because given the fact that we have Silicon Valley and Russia doesn't, if the military, you know, technological complex was really doing what it's supposed to do, we would have some pretty great drones, right? That Russia can't match and cannot counter. But we actually didn't. In fact, I remember when Petraeus said, wait till they get these Switchblade drones. That was the last I heard about these Switchblade drones. Apparently, they were very effective. And it surprises me. I mean, given the amount of resources of a monetary kind that could be put behind Ukraine, just in terms of its Western European backers and, I don't know, billionaires in America and whatever, I'm kind of surprised that Ukraine still seems largely dependent on their domestic drone industry. These guys are like making drones in basements. And can you explain to me why we're not doing more for them drone-wise?
Well, in part for the same reason that, amazingly enough, it turned out that US and European industry could not produce nearly remotely as many 155mm artillery shells as they needed. And the answer is that drones and artillery shells are cheap. They make only small profits for the military-industrial complex. The drones in particular are not even produced largely by the traditional companies. And it makes much more sense for Raytheon and company and all the retired generals who either are working for Raytheon or are going to work for Raytheon to produce F-35s, aircraft carriers, which are very, very profitable.
And very vulnerable.
But very vulnerable, exactly. But it's also, you know, it's the military version of path dependency. I'm actually writing a piece at the moment talking about how Ukraine can be armed over time and also how Europe can be defended without, precisely without having to spend huge amounts of money on, for example, main battle tanks that have proved astonishingly ineffective in this war. But I refer to the fact that, you know, even after almost 5 years of the First World War, the British commander on the Western Front, Field Marshal Haig, in 1919, wrote that there will always be a place in warfare for the well-bred horse. But of course, he'd only been in the First World War for 4.5 years. For whatever it was, 40 years before that, he'd been riding around on horses. Mm-hmm. And he liked horses. He was attached to horses. Well, today, you know, you've got lots and lots and lots of people, whether for profit or pleasure, who are attached to tanks. The other thing is, you know, tanks are romantic. Tanks make you think of the Blitzkrieg going in one direction in France in 1940, or Patton sweeping in the other direction in 1944, with, you know, the Germans whistling the Panzerlied, and Patton, I don't know what he sang, I suspect probably some Confederate anthem, but wouldn't like to say, really. You don't get that buzz from sitting in a cellar in Kiev, or for that matter in Idaho, you know, manipulating a keyboard to send a drone, or let alone sending a drone off on its own to do its thing while you have a cup of coffee. It's,
Fighter jets, I mean, drones don't have Tom Cruise in them. That's their problem, as something to get a lot of via the normal channels of Pentagon expenditure.
Well, and, you know, what's the Marine slogan? The few, the proud, the Marines. Nobody ever said the few, the proud, the drones.
The drones, no.
I mean, who knows?
Drones don't say anything. That's the problem.
Let's hope not, because otherwise you get into...
They will be. They will be, but that's the next war. So I guess we're not optimistic, right? I mean, when I think about... On the one hand, you lay out your plan... And it seems to me like if you have something at that level of resolution, you should be able to get into serious talks. And I would add that if you, I do think there's something to what I'm saying, is that there's not enough near-term leverage on Russia. And if Trump played the hardball he claimed he was going to play and threaten Russia with more arms to Ukraine credibly, if Russia didn't agree to something Ukraine had agreed to, I do think he could move things along. So if you had some leverage and you had a plan, fine. But I just thinking about how the Trump administration has performed in all of these different domains, where it has rarely demonstrated any constancy of purpose and very often demonstrating no plausible coherence of thought whatsoever, I just can't be optimistic.
I entirely agree. I mean, look at the absolute shambles in the Department of, you know, at the top of the Department of Defense.
I was gonna bring that up next. So in a second, we're going to go into overtime, which will be accessible to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. But first of all, give us a little taste of what you're talking about there. I I mean, I know I have the basic idea, but I'm not sure everyone is familiar with the. The first purge was actually in the national security, the White House national security staff. And then there was a purge in the Pentagon, right? These are mid-level people, but in both cases, it seemed to be a kind of ideological agenda. Well, arguably, at least. And what, I mean, first Hawks got purged and then restrainers got purged, right? Respectively in national security and the Pentagon.
Yeah. Which, you know, reflects, as you say, I mean, these ideological battles over policy, but without a president who is, well, either, you know, a clear line himself, or is interested enough to impose discipline on this process. But all of this is also being exacerbated by just sheer incompetence, because things would not have got nearly as bad as they have had it not also been for this, you know, grotesque signal chat scandal. You know, I mean, discussing military operations on signal. And I mean, you know, by some people at least, you know, who have been serving soldiers, who are supposed to, you know, to know something about this. No, I mean, and that, of course, has added to the whole, in my view, entirely accurate impression of a very chaotic administration. But of course, this shouldn't be a surprise, because before the elections, this is what so many of us expected, because we looked at the Trump administration from 17 to 21 and we said, what a mess. It's going to be a mess again. This will, you know, qualify a lot of what he wants to do. Then, of course, he comes in with Agenda 2025, and it seems with a much more, you know, rigorous, united view of where he's going. But this, to a considerable extent, turns out to be, not a total illusion, because true to some extent at the top level. But it's also, of course, a product of Trump's distrust of the bureaucracy, but also the, frankly, I have to say, I'm so sorry, but the crazy way in which the American system works. I mean, no other system in the world changes thousands of officials every 4 years and replaces, you know, tried, experienced professionals with political appointees with not necessarily any background at all in the areas that they're given to work.
We didn't used to change as many of them as we are doing this time around. Trump, of course, part of his agenda is to expand the number of people who are changed that way. So we're going to go into overtime. Before we and in overtime, I want to pursue this further. And also ask you what your theory is on why Jeffrey Goldberg was in Mike Waltz's signal address book to begin with. I would love to hear your speculation on that. But first, I would say, if you want to listen to the rest of this, click the link in the show notes, become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. We would love to have you. I also want to say, people should check out your work at Responsible Statecraft. Also, you're still tweeting sometimes, is that right?
Sometimes.
And what's your Twitter handle?
Anatol Levin. You look me up.
Makes sense. One word, A-N-A-T-O-L-I-E-V-E-N is in Nancy.
Not real Anatol Levin or fake Anatol Levin or not really Anatol Levin, just Anatol Levin.
Yeah, well, when you've achieved your stature, you don't need to qualify it, right? There's no rival Anatole Levin out there who... thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.